Before he could decide anything, the rebel rode off.
"Dogs don't trail worth a hoot. He's gotta be in here somewheres," he muttered.
"We'll have the right kind of a dog in 2-3 days, another voice answered. "Fields went to Preston for Sully. Snoop Saunders' best bloodhound. He's the one that trailed that murderer clear across northern Texas last spring. Got him, too. No trail gets too cold for that Sully to foller."
The two men rode to the head of the thicket. Jeff knew they would beat it out foot by foot until they found him. He crawled on his hands and knees. Rolling into a gully, he ran, bent low, until he came to a small creek. Hoping to throw them off the scent, he waded into the water with his shoes on. It was then he discovered he had left his bridle and his boots behind. The rebels would soon find them and know he'd been there. All day, he alternately walked and ran. He was tired and hungry and discouraged, but he didn't dare stop. The chase was fast approaching a climax. It had become a grim, compelling game. When Fields arrived with that bloodhound, it was going to be even grimmer. That night, Jeff came to a river. He saw the banks were high and steep. Entering the water from a ford downstream, he waded to a sandy place directly below the highest bank, where he crawled out and lay beneath some willow bushes, covering himself up in the warm sand almost at the water's edge. The last thing he remembered was the whippoorwills. When he awoke, the sun was shining brightly. Sleepily, he raked the sand off himself and found that his feet and legs were still wet, but he felt refreshed. A stick broke on the bank above him. Jeff caught his breath. There sat a big, dark-skinned rebel on a gray horse. With him were the same two black dogs Jeff had seen yesterday in the hazel clump. Jeff heard voices and knew the searchers had arrived in force. Cautiously, he eased first one foot, then the other into the river. Then he lowered his whole body into it until only his nose and forehead stuck out. The water was cold, but he didn't care. He hoped the willow leaves would hide him. Trembling with cold and fear, he lay perfectly still in the opaque water, watching them hunt for him. They had plenty of men to do the hunting. Soon the tops of both riverbanks were black with Indians and rebel soldiers mounted and on foot. The Indians looked like Creeks. In the hot sunshine, their greased faces glistened. They were poking into the brush piles with their rifles and shotguns. Jeff was thankful that the bank behind him was so steep that they couldn't get down. With a feeling of annoyance, he thought of his pistol in his waistband. The water had ruined the loads. Now he had no weapon but his knife. The rebels didn't give up. All afternoon, Jeff lay in the water and watched them look for him. He didn't recognize any of them. It seemed there were more in the afternoon than there had been even in the morning. Jabbering and eating with their fingers the cold beef they had brought along in their saddlebags. The smell of the food was almost unendurable. He hadn't eaten in 3 whole days. Jeff stayed in the water until after sundown. Gradually, everything became quieter. When the wolves started howling savagely close by, he thought he had never heard a sweeter sound. It meant the rebels had gone. The moon was up. Jeff set his course by the North Star. Each morning early before he went to sleep, he located the North Star in the heavens, then marked its direction with several stones or sticks, so if it was cloudy when he started walking each night, he could stay on his course without getting lost. He had got the idea from Heifer, whose last act before crawling into his bunk had always been to turn the tongue of the commissary wagon toward the North Star, so that if it were overcast next morning and they were in unfamiliar country, they would take the right direction. The hunger cramps and the fatigue hit him at the same time. Wanting only to get away, he hadn't particularly noticed the cramps before. But now they struck like the blade of a hot bowie knife held against his stomach, and he had to walk more slowly. He was chilled to the bone. He wondered how long it would be before Fields and the bloodhound overtook him. He had never seen a bloodhound, but he had heard his father speak of what wonderful noses they had and how, back in Kentucky, the sheriffs and marshals used them to track down criminals. Jeff knew his rambling trail would be easy to follow. That Texas hound would sniff it up at a gallop. He smelled pine trees ahead. When he awoke, a cool north breeze was blowing on him, carrying the clean, strong smell of the pines. Chilled, Jeff blew upon his hands. It was late September. There would soon be frost in these mountains. He stood, weak and stiff and hungry. There was no sound save the scolding bark of a buck squirrel and the high, thin, bugle-like notes of an ivory-billed woodpecker. He began walking again. Once he surprised a small, short-eared owl dozing on the limb of a sycamore. Flushing it with a stick, he watched it flap away through vertical streaks of sunshine that leaked in through the tops of the pines. He saw a wolf, a catamount, and even a small brown bear waddling up a draw. There were so many wild animals prowling about that he concluded the rebels weren't around and therefore it might be safe to travel in the daytime. Every step he took, he saw birds and flowers and occasionally an animal he had never seen in his life before. He wished Noah were here to help identify them. He wished Noah were here with a couple of big strong horses, a knapsack full of food, and about a gallon of hot Union coffee. Then he thought of Heifer and the commissary wagon back at Boggy. It was breakfast time in the rebel camp. The rebel range was full of fat beeves, and the flour had come up from Texas. Heifer would be turning the pink T-bones in his Dutch ovens, searing them to hold the juices in. Then he would take his gouge hook and lift the lids to see if his sourdough biscuits were browning properly. The light, tightly packed dough gods, as Hooley called them, stood 7 inches high. Jeff's mouth watered. Ahead of him loomed the mountains, rounded, pine-covered. He was sure he couldn't climb the first one. He braced and began to labor up the rise, concentrating on each step and thinking of Pete Milholland and his words, "You can always go farther than you think you can." It was funny how a fellow could lie moldering in his grave and still his words could go right on helping people. He paused to eat a cluster of wild grapes, greedily swallowing some of the seeds. The tart, reddish-purple juice tasted good, but there wasn't enough of it. It was cool in the shade beneath the pines. A flock of wild turkeys arose with a thunder of wings. At noon, he came to a wide road with deep ruts made by wagons. He knew it was the road running east from Perryville to Fort Smith. It was an important landmark, and he felt a little encouraged, knowing he was roughly halfway to the fort. His head throbbed. Black spots came before his eyes. He knew now what hunger meant. What that line in the Lord's Prayer meant that he had repeated 1,000 times without thinking. Give us this day our daily bread. He lay down in the sunshine to rest, but each time it was a little harder to get up. He thought, one of these times, I'm not going to get up. Ahead, the limestone mountains looked still higher and more rugged. Sighing with despair, he walked down into the valley between the two ranges. It was growing dark. A strange sound came to his ears, a strange domestic sound that had no business existing in the vast wilderness of green timber rolling endlessly over one round domed hill after another. It was the sound of a spinning wheel. The sound died away, and Jeff smiled sadly. In his delirium, his ears were playing him tricks. Then he heard it again, a steady, mechanical humming. And all at once he came upon a small shanty set in a dogwood thicket 100 yards away. He lay down in the brush to watch. Presently, a woman in a blue dress came out the door carrying a piggin of shelled corn. She had black hair. Going to a small steel mill fastened to a big oak, she ground the corn in the mill, then took it back inside. Soon gray smoke began to spiral out of the fireplace chimney. Two men walked up. Each was heavily armed and carried his rifle into the house with him. Jeff didn't see a horse on the place. Sighing, he guessed it didn't make any difference. He doubted if he had strength enough now to mount a horse, let alone catch one. He didn't even have a bridle. He smelled cornbread baking and beef roasting in the fireplace, and again the hunger cramps grabbed him, twisting cruelly at his vitals. His appetite became so savage that it took all his willpower not to rush into the house and snatch the food away from them. Afraid their dogs might scent him and raise an alarm, he backed through a briar patch, cutting his hands on the brambles, and circled the place widely. Doggedly, he kept plodding forward. He was so tired now that he took his knife and cut himself a thick willow stick, using it for a cane. Just before dusk, the country grew flatter and gold-washed, with autumnal wildflowers. He came to a wide river with cottonwood and black willow growing along its sandy shore. Jeff knew it was the Canadian River. Cautiously, he scanned both its banks. The great current rippled gently as it flowed in lazy loops and whirls among the sandbars. He might have to swim across. Taking off his clothing, he waded tentatively into the shallows. The water was warm. It rose to his waist, and his feet touched sand and flat stones on the bottom. He got across safely, waded out, and slipped into his ragged pants and shirt. Very weak now, he started walking slowly northward, then pulled up, staring incredulously. Several buildings loomed ghost-like in the woodsy gloom ahead. The place seemed empty and uninhabited. It was dark and cool beneath the trees. He felt faint. Staggering inside the nearest building, he lay down on the dusty plank floor. He was sure he had come to the end of his rope. If he had to die, this would be as good a place as any. What a fool he had been not to show himself at that shanty he had passed in the afternoon. The floor was covered with old paper. The room smelled musty. Apparently it had once been occupied by rebel soldiers. On the floor he found an old voucher dated North Fork Town, August 7, 1863. It was signed by General Douglas H. Cooper. Was this North Fork Town? He was too tired to care. He tried to sleep, but packs of snarling wolves kept entering the deserted town. It sounded as if they were chasing other creatures out. In the morning he was awakened by a wild hog squealing in terror. He hobbled out to investigate and found a pack of wolves had killed it and had part of its intestines out on the ground. Yelling and waving his stick, Jeff drove them off. The young ones ran away, but the old one sat only a few yards distant, hungrily watching him. With his knife, he peeled the skin off the hog's flanks and hewed off most of both hams. He carried the meat back into the house, leaving the rest for the wolves. He ransacked the house and finally found two dry matches. By that time, the wolves had devoured the remains of the hog and were gone. Carefully, he gathered dry twigs, grass, and leaves. His hand trembled so badly when he struck the first match that he dropped it on the ground and it went out. Muttering a prayer, he scratched the last match on a small rock. With a loud crackle, the yellow flame flared up. Exultantly, Jeff touched it to the grass. Soon, he had a fire going. With his knife, he sliced off a slab of the pink ham. Using two green sticks, he suspended it over the fire. Maddened by the smell of the cooking meat and the hiss of the juice dropping into the flames, he cut off a bite of the half-cooked meat and began to chew it. At first it had no taste. Then the saliva came back into his mouth, and he gulped it down. It felt like a rock in his stomach. He cut himself another piece and gorged it down, too, unable to control himself. He kept cutting up the hams and shoulders, barbecuing them as fast as he could. For 3 days, Jeff lay around, cooking and eating the ham and recovering enough of his strength to start north again. Each day he practiced walking, touring the abandoned town. On the morning of the fourth day, he set out, a willow stick in his hand, striding northeastward along a wide highway whose dimly marked ruts were all grown over with green Bermuda. He knew it must be the Texas Road. It seemed odd to see the big thoroughfare so silent and deserted. He guessed he walked 6 miles that morning. In late afternoon of the following day, he passed a small creek. Horse skeletons lay on the ground and broken-down wagons without wheels. The place looked familiar. Jeff recognized Elk Creek, scene of the Battle of Honey Springs in which Bostwick had died. For the first time since he had left Boggy Depot, he began to think he was going to make it. With every step he took, he felt a little stronger. He couldn't be more than 20 miles from Fort Gibson now. He wondered how the Dunn was, and if they had taken good care of him. He thought of Noah, and Bill Earle, and Stuart Mitchell, and David Gardner, and suddenly found himself wanting very much to see them all. He moved off the broad Texas road where he could easily be seen and began to walk in the brush. Ahead, he could faintly smell willows and water and mud. He knew he was nearing the Arkansas River. He was walking through a green patch of tamarisk and sandbar willow when he heard the baying of a hound. The sound came from far behind him in almost exactly the direction he had been traveling. A long, low, melancholy moaning that swelled into a deep, sobbing roar, filling the air like a hunting horn. The hills and hollows back of Jeff rang with its weird howling. Terror cramped his stomach muscles. He quickened his stride. He knew it was the Texas bloodhound Fields had gone to Preston after. He threw away his stick and began running. A feeling of bitterness and disaster surged over him. He was trapped almost at the fort's threshold. The hound would lead the rebels to him long before he reached the river. "This time they've got me, sure," he said to himself. "They may not even bother to take me back to Boggy. This may be my last 15 minutes on earth." His breath began to snag in his throat, and he slowed to a fast walk. Long bars of light from the sinking sun fell across his path. The hound sounded much closer now. It yelped and whimpered eagerly as the trail grew hot and it realized it was close upon the quarry it had been so long pursuing. Jeff felt the sweat running down his nose and his tired feet chafing in his broken shoes. The hound was coming faster and faster. Suddenly, it broke into a long, full-throated roar of triumph, and he knew it had sighted him. His skinny ribs heaved like bellows under his torn blouse. Pouring out the last of his fading energy, he ran 20 more faltering steps, then staggered and fell headlong into a small depression. He couldn't get up. Panting in utter exhaustion, he turned over on one elbow and waited for them, his heart thumping wildly. A thin, continuous patter of racing feet approached over the hard, smooth sand. There was a loud snuffling. Then the tall grass above him swished and parted. A big, liver-colored hound thrust its ugly head through the grass. Its forehead was pitted with long, deep wrinkles, wet with perspiration. It had low-hanging jowls, and its long ears hung down like cabbage leaves. When it opened its mouth to pant, its long pink tongue dropped almost to the ground. Bracing itself with its front feet, it regarded Jeff solemnly. Staring at the dog, Jeff felt no horror of it. Its sad face reminded him of an old man rather than a monster. The hound peered at Jeff and then back over its shoulder as if to say to its followers, "He's here." But Jeff heard no sounds of approaching horsemen. Apparently the hound had outrun its handlers. The closer he looked at it, the more it seemed like any other dog except for its terribly homely face. He felt a flash of hope. He had never seen a dog he didn't like, nor one he couldn't pet. He crawled to his knees, tottering dizzily. Holding out one hand, he talked kindly to the hideous-looking animal. Its long tail began to wag back and forth, sweeping the sand behind it in a smooth half-circle and sending the small twigs flying. Jeff got one foot under him and stood weakly. The dog walked slowly up and sniffed loudly at Jeff's clothing, satisfying itself that Jeff was the scent it had been following for miles. He felt the suckling pressure of its nose on his legs and ankles. It sounded as if it had rollers in its nose. He reached behind its ears and rubbed its head gently. Its police spirit fading, the hound forgot duty completely. It sat down, permitting him to fondle it at will. Jeff examined his collar and saw the name Sully engraved on a tiny brass plate. It was the Texas Hound, all right. But where were Fields and the rebels? He tottered out of the depression and looked and listened to the south. Although he saw nothing, he could faintly hear cursing and shouts somewhere in the gathering dusk behind him. He didn't wait to hear more. Reaching into his shirt, he pulled out the last of his barbecued ham and gave it to the hound. The animal sniffed curiously at it, then bolted it down. Jeff whistled coaxingly and held out his hand.
"Come on, Sully," he invited, using his most persuasive tones.
Without hesitation, the dog began to follow him. Jeff was elated. As long as he had the bloodhound, its rebel masters were going to have a hard time finding his trail in the dark. He was careful to stay on the grass and out of the soft sand where his footprints would be easily visible. Plodding along steadily, boy and dog vanished into the river canebrakes. Next morning, an hour after sunrise, a squadron of Union cavalry riding patrol 5 miles below Fort Gibson saw them emerging out of the river mists. The lieutenant in charge, a medium-sized fellow with a big Roman nose, pulled his mount to a stop. Pushing his hat back on his shaggy blonde head, he stared incredulously.
"Looks like a man walking, but what in Sam Hill's that with him? Maybe we better go see."
They came cantering up, and the lieutenant, riding at the head of the column, hoisted his fist, halting the patrol. The boy was all skin and bones and dirt. And where in the world had he found the sad-faced hound that accompanied him? Jeff saw their blue uniforms with the yellow braid down the side of the trousers. For a moment, he feasted his eyes upon them. Pants and blouses all the same color, sabers and carbines and metal canteens, every man dressed and equipped alike and riding a 1,000-pound horse. No patches, nor ponies, nor shotguns, nor clay jugs. His eyes misted over. They were the prettiest sight he had ever seen in his life. Wearily, he shoved his heels together and saluted. The hound sat down beside him.
"Sir, I'm Private Bussy. I'm just getting back from being 14 months overdue on a scout. I have some very important information. Please take me to General Blunt at once."
The lieutenant looked queerly at him.
"General Blunt ain't assigned here now. He was transferred back to Kansas a year ago. Colonel Waddles is in charge of the fort. We can take you to him, I reckon."
When he heard the lieutenant's voice, Jeff's mouth popped open and his bloodshot eyes lighted up with recognition.
"Sir, you're Lieutenant Orff, aren't you? Don't you know me, Lieutenant? Remember stopping the rebel charge with your Spencer that day we were returning from the scout across the Arkansas?"
Orff gaped.
"Gosh, all fishhooks, it's Bussy."
He spoke so loudly the whole patrol heard him. A bay horse turned out of the column. The tall cavalryman astride it rode alongside Jeff.
"Whoa!" he growled commandingly to his horse.
Climbing off, he picked Jeff up bodily and with a mighty swoop of his wide shoulders, swung him easily into the saddle. Then he mounted behind.
"Howdy, youngster," he drawled. "Where you been all this time?"
Jeff grabbed at him with both hands and held on weakly.
"Noah," he blurted.
He had never felt so glad in his life. They moved off at a swinging gallop. Jeff craned his neck around, anxiously watching the hound behind him.
"Noah, don't let him lose my new dog. He wouldn't dare go back to Texas now. They'd stand him up before a firing squad and shoot him full of holes. Is he coming?"
Noah looked back over his shoulder.
"He sure is. Like the heel flies was after him. Runs easy, too. Looks like he'd go all day without a drink. He seems to think he's your dog, all right. Ugly as galvanized sin, ain't he?
Where'd you take up with something as raunchy looking as that?
Jeff grinned.
It's a long story, he said.
Chapter 25. Linn County, Kansas, 1865. Jeff rode north up the military road. It was a cloudy morning in June 1865. The war was over, and they were going home. It was hard to get used to being out of the Army. He had traveled so widely, learned so much, and had so many things happen to him that it seemed he'd been gone 15 years instead of nearly 4. He wanted very much to see his family, and he wanted very much to see Kansas, now that peace had finally come. They came to the crossing of a small creek spilling noisily across the road. The dun's ears flattened warily. After last night's rains, everything was fresh and cool. The road was muddy, and puddles stood in the weed-grown fields. The sky was dappled with big, cottony thunderheads drifting lazily northward, speckling the wet green earth with great moving shadows. Steering with his knees, Jeff urged the dun into the shallow brown torrent. The horse was in good condition. Blunt's orders to the grooms at Fort Gibson had been plain on that score after Lehman Jones had faithfully delivered every word of Jeff's message.
"Some rain," said John Chadwick. "Regular old frog strangler," said David Gardner.
"It rained so hard I didn't know whether it was lightning at the thunder or thundering at the lightning," said Bill Earle.
Mounted, they followed Jeff into the stream. The four of them had been mustered out. They planned to stay that night with Bill's Aunt Phoebe, who lived half a mile over the Missouri state line on the road to Neosho. Bill called her his Confederate aunt because her slaves had never left her when she offered them their freedom. Her two-story home had been one of the few spared by rival raiders during the war. A mourning dove cooed from a roadside elm. Its pensive song seemed a lament for the waste and ruin Jeff saw everywhere. All the way north from Fort Gibson, he had been shocked by the destruction. When they had hiked down the same road as infantry, with Weir in 62, the Cherokee farms had been prosperous, and well-kept herds of cattle and droves of hogs grazed on the rich tribal pasturage. But now, everything was changed. Fire-blackened chimneys thrust themselves gray and stark against the June sky. To Jeff, they seemed like gravestones marking the spots where happy families had once lived. He remembered the fine orchards, the radiant lawns, the whitewashed plank fences, and the broad valleys filled with tasseling corn he had seen 3 years before. Houses, barns, outbuildings, corrals, all had been burned. The splendid shade trees were now lifeless stumps. Fences were torn down, wells had caved in, farming tools had been carried off, every hoof and horn swept away. The fields were dense with weeds growing higher than the corn ever had. Occasionally they passed places where a house still stood, lonely and eyeless, its windows and doors gone and the frames and sills torn out. Sometimes they saw the former owners had returned and were camped in the yard, bravely beginning the long, slow rehabilitation of their property. Jeff watched with pity their rude efforts to work the soil with crudely sharpened sticks or with a solitary horse or plow that would pass as a loan over an entire neighborhood for a whole season. The Union Cherokee soldiers hadn't been mustered out until May 31st, too late to plant corn. Even Colonel Phillips had resigned his commission. In a short speech to his men, he had thanked them for their bravery and their loyalty. "God bless you all," he had concluded. "I am now going home and help Nellie peel peaches." Jeff thought of the rebel Cherokee families down on Red River. The war was over for them, too. But he knew they couldn't return to their ravaged homes in the Cherokee country until the peace treaty had been made, and that might take months. Sighing, he wondered if the Jackmans' big home near Briartown had been burned. He hoped not. His association with the rebels had taught him a tolerance and sympathy for the defeated side,
that he would keep all his life. He thought the South had been wrong to start the war, but now that it was over and the Union restored, he didn't want to see the rebels punished unreasonably. He hoped the country would be united again, bigger and stronger than ever, North and South. Just before sundown, they turned off the road and trotted down a long cedar lane to the home of Bill's Aunt Phoebe. It was the finest home Jeff had seen since he had left the Jackmans. A Negro man met them at the main gate. He was carrying a pair of shears, several large towels, and a big square bar of homemade lye soap. He looked with fear at their weapons and their blue uniforms.
"Mistress, say I'm to take y'all gentlemen's to the spring house for a bath and clean up. Then you're to come to the house for supper."
Bill blushed, looking around apologetically at the others.
"Aunt Phoebe's cranky about dirt and graybacks. She means all right, but she was born with her hands on her hips."
Jeff didn't mind. As usual, he was hungry enough to eat his own saddle blanket. He noticed that Aunt Phoebe's phobia for cleanliness included her servants. The Negro's curly hair was slicked down neatly. His black shoes were shined, and his clothing was neat. He smelled nice and clean. Lots cleaner than they smelled after their long ride in the sticky heat, he knew. They dismounted. The Negro's eyes bugged whitely when he saw the fierce-looking bloodhound standing gravely beside Jeff.
"Is dat a hound dat chased one ob yo' gentlemen's all de way from Red River to de fort?"
They all laughed. The story of Jeff's long flight on foot from the weighty headquarters and of the renowned Texas bloodhound had been told hundreds of times all up and down the Texas road.
"He don't look like no bloodhound. He too ugly."
Bill Earl turned toward the dog.
"Sure he's a bloodhound. Ain't you, Sully? Bleed for the man, Sully."
But the hound seemed to know he was being teased. Staring at them with his mournful eyes, he stood closer to Jeff. Jeff reached down and stroked his long ears. The Negro led them into the spring house, a large room of blackjack logs that had been built over a live spring in the floor. It was cool there. The clear, cold water bubbled out of a short length of hickory log that had been bored by an extension auger to make a pipe. The place was almost nice enough to live in. The walls were stained a grayish white. There were chairs, a table, and a large cabinet built from sassafras saplings. Everything was scrupulously clean. They stripped. With his shears, the Negro clipped each head carefully for lice. Then they bathed with a lye soap, towed themselves, and donned clean gray cotton drawers, blouses, pants, and socks. Jeff felt clean and strange in the borrowed garments. Another Negro fed and rubbed down their horses and gave Jeff some beef for Sully. Missing his blue blouse, Jeff looked out the window and saw the first Negro hold it up and stare at the three yellow stripes on the shoulder, before hanging it on a stone fence to air. Jeff was going home a sergeant. He had found the promotion waiting for him the day he rode back to the fort. Blunt had seen to it personally after Lehman Jones arrived. As he stuffed his borrowed blouse into his pants, Jeff thought about how he had joined up at 16, wanting to be a soldier, to see battle and savor adventure. Well, he had got what he wanted, and more. Although he was barely 20, he had served the Union as an infantryman, cavalryman, and scout. With 2 hours as an impromptu artilleryman at the Battle of Prairie Grove thrown in. And during his service with the South, he had been both a cavalryman and a teamster. He had lain ill several months in a rebel home, nearly escaped a rebel firing squad, had nearly starved to death, been trailed 100 miles by a bloodhound, and fallen head over heels in love. Few men in either army had lived the war so fully. Bill's aunt, tall and austere, met them at the door. Jeff had never seen a more meticulous woman. Nothing had a chance to be out of place in her parlor. If you laid something down, she picked up after you in your presence.
She sent a Negro girl out onto the Bermuda lawn with a dustpan to scoop up the quid of tobacco John Chadwick had spat out. But she set a good table. After supper, they went into the parlor. There, Aunt Phoebe thawed a little. Bill sang several religious hymns while she accompanied him on an organ. She pumped with her foot and fingered the keys with long, flowing gestures of her hands and wrists. One of the songs was Amazing Grace, and with a stab of melancholy, Jeff's thoughts went back to Boggy Depot, and he heard Heifer humming the same tune in his broken, sobbing voice as he pounded out his stakes with the butt of his double-barreled pistol. When they changed back into their own clothing next morning and got ready to leave, Bill elected to stay behind and rest up a week before going on to his home in northern Kansas. Jeff thanked Aunt Phoebe. Then he shook hands with Bill, feeling kind of foolish. Bill promised to come and visit the Bussy homestead after he got settled.
"What are you going to do when you get home? Go back to school at Bluemont?" Jeff asked. "Heck no! I'm going to get me a rocking chair and sit in it and rest. After I rest about 6 months, I might even rock a little."
"You going to school, Jeff?" Jeff nodded. "I hear they're opening the new university next year at Lawrence. That's where I'm heading. It's only about 60 miles from home." He put his foot in the stirrup and swung up on the dun's back. The bloodhound got up from where he had been lying on the grass and looked at Jeff with doleful expectancy. Jeff glanced once more at Bill and raised his hand. As they rode off down the cedar kite track, Jeff swallowed a couple of times. It was hard to leave a comrade you had eaten with, bunked with, and fought with so long. It reminded Jeff of his parting with Noah. Noah had gotten his discharge in May and returned to his home in Illinois. With a lump in his throat, Jeff had taken Noah by the hand and thanked him for all he had done. He told Noah that he would never forget him and made him promise to stop at Sugar Mound and see him the first time he came through Kansas on one of his long hikes as a tramp printer.
"I'll come by and see you, youngster, but I won't be walking."
Noah pointed over his shoulder. Jeff saw the bay bridled and saddled and tied to a cannon wheel.
"Old Cold Jaw here is going to be my locomotion from now on, now that I finally learned how to stay on him. He's so gentle I can stake him to a hairpin."
Noah had bought the bay from the government the same way Jeff had purchased the dun, for $75 taken out of his pay. Jeff had found Lehman Jones, too, when he got back to the fort. The Negro boy had decided to stay in the North and join the 1st Kansas Colored Infantry, a Union Negro regiment trained at Baxter Springs, Kansas. He had seen some hard fighting and been shot through the shoulder during a skirmish at a hay camp near Flat Rock. When the war ended, he intended to homestead a farm somewhere in Kansas and bring his old mother to live with him. Clardy never returned. After Jeff told Colonel Waddles about the repeating rifles, the colonel rushed a full report by courier to Fort Scott. It was telegraphed to Leavenworth, St. Louis, and Washington, and the illegal traffic through Kansas stopped. No one knew what had become of Clardy. He was nowhere to be found. When Jeff didn't return from his scout with Bostwick, General Blunt personally wrote his parents, sending them Jeff's personal belongings, including the Medal of Honor he had won at Prairie Grove. Later, when Jeff turned up at the fort, Colonel Waddles wrote again to Jeff's father, detailing the important service he had rendered the nation. When Jeff and David and John crossed the Kansas state line just southeast of Baxter Springs, their excitement grew. They arrived first at the timbered boundary of the Gardner farm, and David stared unbelievingly from beneath his heavy white eyebrows at the corn growing in the thin, rocky soil. The rows were straight, and the crop looked good. A sleek, fat cow grazed in a pasture with a new calf gamboling at her side. Farther on, they saw a small patch of wheat and a garden heavy with tomatoes. Apparently, there had been plenty of rain. As they rode up to the house, a small black dog charged them, barking shrilly at the bloodhound. Jeff had never seen it before. He felt a vague alarm, wondering if David's mother had moved. But when David called, the red-headed gardener brood poured out of the house into the yard, and Jeff was surprised to see how much they had grown. Both girls were taller than their mother, but they had her plain, homely face and freckles. David got down off his horse.
"It's David!"
Mrs. Gardner cried and ran forward to throw both arms around his neck. She was so glad to see him that she began pounding him with both fists. Recognizing Jeff and John, she greeted them too. Bashful and smiling, the two girls stepped forward to be kissed. David pecked them both dutifully on the cheek. A muscular, red-haired lad of 10 ran up from the new barn built of poles and straw. There was mud on his bare feet and awe and excitement in his face. David grinned.
"Hello, Bobby. Well, I didn't get killed after all, and my bones ain't bleaching on no prairie."
Bobby stood there with his mouth open, staring first at his brother and then at the gaunt, sad-faced bloodhound. A stranger followed Bobby from the barn, carrying a pitchfork. He was small in stature. To Jeff, he looked like an old gray rooster whose tail feathers had been draggled by the rain. His black hair was sprinkled with gray. Timidly, he stood in the background, as though reluctant to intrude upon David's homecoming. Beaming, Mrs. Gardner turned to David.
"David, this is your new pappy."
Then Jeff knew why the cornrows were so straight. He and John rode on. As they angled off to the Chadwick farm, John straightened in the saddle, watching for familiar landmarks. Grown and heavily bearded, he stood 6'2" and weighed 210 pounds, easily the biggest man in his company.
"Think my old man'll still try to whoop me for joining up?" he laughed.
At the same woodpile, where he had thrown down the armful of blackjack logs when he left for Leavenworth with Jeff, he stopped his horse. Crawling off, he tied him to the saw rack. Grinning mischievously, he stooped and picked up an armload of logs and carried them toward the house. His father and mother came to the door, staring at him as though he was a stranger.
"Howdy, Pa," he said. "Well, I finally got back with the wood."
Then they recognized him. Elated, they rushed forward to greet him, chattering joyfully. Now Jeff rode alone. The dun nodded his head patiently up and down as he walked down the center of the narrow road, sweat running off his flanks. The bloodhound trotted along in the brush, his long, intelligent nose woofing and snorting loudly as he read the roadside trail like a newspaper. If the hound had been able to talk, Jeff was sure it could have told him the identity of every creature that had passed that way for a week. It was late afternoon. With sweet nostalgia, he drank in the green Kansas countryside, the fragrance of the alfalfa and sweet clover, the pastures blued over with wildflowers, the creeks and ponds shining like glass in the setting sun, the quail whistling cheerfully from the corn. He felt good clear through about it all. No more violence and crime in Kansas. No more trouble with the Missourians. The land was calm and peaceful at last. Jeff was proud he had helped bring it about. Impatient, he wanted to shake up the reins and gallop the dun on in, but he knew the horse was tired. In his saddlebags were a pair of prunella shoes for his mother to wear to church, a bolt of blue cotton cloth, and a skein of silk. For his sisters, there were shawls and shell-side combs. For his father, several twists of tobacco, a satin vest, and a new pair of calfskin boots. He had purchased it all from the sutler's store at Fort Gibson. He passed the spot where he had thrown rocks at Ring the morning the dog had tried to follow him to Fort Leavenworth. He knew the house was just around the corner. He smelled smoke and saw a thin gray wisp curling above the trees. He knew it came from his mother's fireplace, and a fresh wave of homesickness washed over him. as the road leaned familiarly to the left, he caught his first view of his father's house. It looked different. He saw that an extra room had been built off the west side. A new rail fence ran around the yard. The trees looked twice as tall as when he had left 4 years before. But the corral fence of peeled cottonwood logs was still there. As he trotted up, a big gray dog with a white ring around his neck leaped up from the shade of the parked carryall and, with a low growl, trotted out, springy-legged, to smell noses with the bloodhound. Jeff's heart jumped exultantly. It was Ring.
"Ring," he called. "Don't you know me?"
When Ring heard Jeff's voice, he cocked his ears and forgot all about the hound. In two bounds, he was at Jeff's stirrup, wild with excitement. Whining eagerly and springing up on his hind legs, the dog took sky hops, almost as high as the saddle, trying to reach Jeff. The dun snorted and shied to one side. Jeff quieted him and dismounted. Before he could tie the horse, Ring sprang upon him. Laughing happily, Jeff pulled the big dog's ears and scratched his back. Finally, he tied the horse by the woodpile and walked across the chip-strewn yard to the house. A girl came out the back door. Her mouth parted in surprise. She wore a simple cotton gown of purple. She was slim and shapely, with a couple of cinnamon-colored freckles high on the bridge of her nose. Jeff grinned at her. She had sure grown up, but she didn't fool him any. After seeing David's sisters, he was prepared.
"Jeff!"
she shouted, and ran to meet him. Throwing both arms around his middle, she hid her brown head under his arm. Her cry aroused the whole house. Jeff gave her a big squeeze and kissed her on top of her warm, clean-smelling head.
"How are you, Bess?"
She gasped, and, looking up at him, giggled.
"Why, Jeff, don't you know me? I'm Mary. Bess is married. She lives over by the trading post with her husband. They're coming to visit us tomorrow."
Now it was Jeff's turn to look surprised. Jeff embraced his mother and father. They looked fine. His mother was crying. She said it wasn't Jeff at all he had grown so much. His father gazed at him with quiet pride and satisfaction. Mary claimed it was a miracle he hadn't been shot, considering all he had been through. Jeff laughed.
"A running target is hard to hit, sis. I was too small for their rough sights."
And so, Jeff came home. Later, after he had helped his father do the feeding and milking, they had supper in the firelit kitchen. He told them the whole story. When he had finished, it was very late. His mother arose and quietly left the room. Returning, she handed Jeff a letter.
"It's for you. It came by Army Courier to Sugar Mound and was sent by a Colonel Matthews. He was in Doaksville in the Choctaw Indian Nation receiving the surrender of the Confederate Indian forces. He said a Captain Washburn handed him the letter personally to give to you."
Jeff's heart gave a glad leap when he saw Lucy's name written in small, neat letters in the upper left-hand corner. Moving near the fireplace, he tossed a handful of dry chips on the coals and carefully slit the envelope open. He pulled out the two folded pages of ruled paper torn from a record book and began to read.
"Boggy Depot, CSA, May 27th, 1865. My dear Jeff, you cannot imagine how thankful I was to learn you got back safely to Fort Gibson. When I heard you were on foot and our soldiers were close on your trail, I had no breath to speak. I thought of you all alone out there in the hills and how you could never be rid of the awful fear of being captured and executed. I don't know how you did it with the whole country after you. You must have done a great deal of praying as well as running. I couldn't run for you, but I prayed hard for you every day. Once I heard that the hounds had run you down and mangled you terribly. Another time I heard you were dead. We do not know what to believe here anymore. There is so much rumor. Our refugee home is a log house 11 miles west of Boggy Depot near Blue River. When I heard after the dance that something went wrong and they were after you, I told my father everything. He knew about the rifles. He told me about having one of our men sing a certain song across the river to signal when we had the gold ready to buy the contraband rifles. Father had just returned from Texas. He went to Boggy Depot and talked to General Wadey. The general promised to let us know when you were taken. When they got me up in the middle of the night to tell me they had lost the hound and you had escaped, my pulses throbbed and then almost ceased to throb at all. I knew before I answered the door that you were dead. Thank God I was wrong. The war is over here, and I am glad. General Wadey gave nearly all our boys a furlough in March so they could help the families put in a crop. Boggy Depot is desolate. The streets are quiet. We had already lost our homes and property. Now we have lost the war. It is so dreary in town that one feels it is almost sacrilegious to laugh. Everybody here is worrying about what kind of terms we will get in the peace treaty. I am wearing my last calico frock, and it is mended in many places. Most of my nice dresses were left behind in the trunk at Tahlequah. We have learned to make fine-flavored coffee from roasted okra seeds, and now everybody is planting long rows of okra along the edges of the cornfields. Before our cow died, we churned every day, but we didn't drink the precious buttermilk. We made biscuits of it instead. Tonight, we have nothing to eat, so I'm going to bed early and fill up on sleep. I saw Hooley Pogue taking a walk around the hospital block the other day. He was the raggedest, shabbiest, most patched-up little fellow I ever saw. When I told him I was going to write to you, he said, "Tell you to keep the hound." He said, "If that hound ever shows up here again, Fields will have him court-martialed." Hooley's wound is almost healed. He told Father and me about you holding him on his horse all the way back from Pheasant Bluff. I told him and Father how you were forced into our army by Bostwick's remark. Mother had already told Father how good you were to us at Tahlequah. I think he would have tried to help you even if they had caught you. Hooley introduced us to Mr. Hobbs, the cook. He looked so lonely, I felt sorry for him. We heard later he went back to his ranch in Texas, and that he gave your pony and saddle to the youngest Jackman girl. We all want to return to our homes, but Father says we cannot until late this year or early in 1866, after the treaty is made. Father is going to work driving freight wagons. Mother plans to run a boarding house at Fort Gibson, catering to the Union officers there. After feeding that polite Wisconsin major at our home in 1862, she has decided that many of your officers are nice people. I almost forgot to tell you about Clardy. When they didn't catch you, he was afraid to go north. Meanwhile, some of his followers became intoxicated, and our people found out what his real name was, and that he was the one who had ordered Lee's execution. A few days later, he was found stabbed to death, and his $12,000 gone. Some say he was slain in revenge. Others think his own companions murdered him. Hooley Pogue said, "I'll bet he's in hell pumping thunder at 3 cents a clap." We are excited to hear that our Methodist conference will soon start up again. Now that the war is over and a minister is coming, nearly everybody here plans to get married. Remember the plans you and I made under the redbud tree at Boggy? Jeff, please don't make me wait too long. I've said no 3 times in the last 2 weeks. Soon I'll be the only unmarried girl in the refugee country. Your dog Dixie is with us. She is the family watchdog and pet. We all love her very much. I hope you don't want her back too soon. She is all I have to remember you by.
You should have seen me milk the cow before we lost her. Mother said I did it almost as well as Jed, our slave who ran away. I do most of the cooking when we have anything to cook. I am learning to weave and spin. You already know how well I sew. Except when I grow angry and stick my finger with a needle. Jeff, when are you coming to see me? I wish with all my heart that you were here tonight. I don't think it would be safe for you to come now. Wait until we get back to Fort Gibson. Then it will be perfectly safe. Please write to me here at Boggy. Please write the day after you receive this. I think of you every day and every night. Do you ever think of me? Ever yours affectionately, Lucy Washburn.
Jeff laid the letter on the sandstone hearth. He sighed deeply.
What did she mean, asking him if he ever thought of her corn? He thought about her all the time.
Lately he had begun worrying about her, too. In a few short months she would go with her family to Fort Gibson and be courted by all those ardent Union officers flocking around her mother's table. A frown puckered his face. He was going to have to do something about it right away. He almost wished she lived at Fort Gibson now so he could start back first thing in the morning. If he ever lost that girl, he'd never get over it. His mother put him on a shuck mattress in the new room. The floor was made of split logs. There was a rag rug on it. He could smell the fragrance of the newly hewn hickory. The walls were plastered with clay and felt smooth to the touch. Through the open south window, a cool breeze was blowing gently, stirring the red cotton curtains Mary had made. Truly, it was a fine room. But Jeff couldn't rest in it. After reading Lucy's letter, his heart kept going back to her and to the fine people on the defeated side who would have to wait another year before they could return to their homes and start making a new life for themselves. From somewhere on the warm night wind, he kept hearing a rowdy banjo tune picked by flying rebel fingers back at Boggy, and tasting Heifer's yeasty dough gods, and feeling the water of the muddy Arkansas arise to his armpits as he rode again with Wadey at Pheasant Bluff, and his regret came like pain. Restless, he climbed through the open window to keep from awakening his family and spread his blankets on the Bermuda outside. Sleeping outdoors on the ground was a habit he would have for many years. He settled back comfortably upon the blanket. The Kansas sky was spangled with blazing stars. They shone so brightly that he imagined he could almost hear the crackle of their fires. Down in the corral, a cowbell tinkled faintly. He felt a slight movement at his side and saw that Ring had joined him and was lying close by, his head upon his forepaws. Reaching over with his hand, Jeff gave the big dog a couple of pats. Then he closed his eyes. Soon he began to breathe deeply and regularly.
The End. You've been listening to Rifles for Waity by Harold Keith, narrated by Tom Stekschulte. This work is copyrighted 1957 by Harold Keith. This recording is copyrighted 1999 by Recorded Books, Incorporated. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Johnny Tremaine by Esther Forbes, narrated by George Guidel, and Under the Blood Red Sun by Graham Salisbury, narrated by Jeff Woodman. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us toll-free using the telephone number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.